So this is a long liturgy, and it is about attending to our bodies, and so I would feel remiss not to check in with you. I don't want to hold anyone hostage. We're at about 10 till. We can go ahead and call it good with this liturgy and sing our final hymn, or do y'all want to hear a sermon? Okay, so I will preach. I invite you to do as you need to with your body. Jerry Coleman McGee's sport of choice, which he has been practicing for more than 3 decades, is rock skipping. He is the world record holder since 1992 for the consecutive number of skips, 38. 38. You can skip stones on lakes, on the ocean, on rivers. You can skip stones on sand. You can apparently also skip them across a cloth covering an antique dining table, but do not try that at home. Skipping stones makes them appear to dance across a surface. As the rock descends in an arc, makes contact, pops back up again, makes contact, then up again, repeating this pattern as far as its momentum will carry it. Selecting a good stone helps. Science tells us this. Needs to have some heft in your hands. And a slightly irregular shape. Aim for something sort of like a triangle. But the real secret of stone skipping is how you throw it. Spin and speed. Working together, those two elements allow a stone to defy gravity. Eventually, the drag of the water on the stone wins. The rock is dragged beneath the surface. As we know in this life, all good things must end. But before that, magic. Magic. In 1854, the first organized group of abolitionist settlers from New England arrives here in Kansas. They immediately found the town of Lawrence. They choose Massachusetts as the name of their main drag, and this is not an accident. They are both honoring their motherland and invoking a powerful legacy. One that has shaped a nation before, and they aim to do it again. Church, schools, a free and politically engaged press are all established within the first 2 years. Their newspaper is called the Herald of Freedom, as I'm sure you know. They found next what will become the University of Kansas, and here too, their aims are not meager. These fiercely devoted dreamers intend to recreate the best of what they have known. If you have heard KU referred to, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, as the Harvard on the caw, you should know that that is no joke. It was precisely the intent. They aimed high, those 19th century prairie colonists, and their achievements made history. For faith, and for freedom. 2 states in the Union have had Unitarian governors. The first is Massachusetts. The other is Kansas. The trajectories that these 2 states have been tied together with for 2 centuries are things that neither now deeply remembers. But the history is now right under our noses. Modern-day archaeologists here in Kansas, when they dug at Quindaro, they found tinned clams, lots of them, when they excavated these first historic town sites. Knowing and loving some Massachusetts Unitarians as I do, this amuses me to no end. And there is indeed much to smile at and indeed to be fiercely proud of. Let yourself feel it, having joined your legacy with their own. This story of these ancestors with whom we have fallen into communion. And there are lessons for us as well. These immigrants brought their culture with them. And they brought their cultural expectations, things about class, race, land, habits and muscle memory, about narrative and history, how we should use words and make rules, and for what purpose. We as a movement are questioning some of those historically rooted cultural expectations right now, and for good reasons. I'll be honest with you. As a young woman minister, now serving in a historic pulpit myself, I am questioning that history too. And I've had to laugh at myself in that an unexpected piece of my research this summer is that I had no idea. I was consigning myself to read so much writing by white men in their 40s and 50s and 60s. Their ways of seeing the world, their conceptions of right and wrong, their dreams for this America. If that is you here in this era, I will answer the question. Yes, you still have a cherished place. Yes, you are still beloved. But you don't get to be the only people. And you don't get to be first. We are going to let those who have not yet had space even to dream to do some imagining for us all. Because here's the thing. It's not that classically educated white men were the only people in this era who thought or who dreamed. They're not even the only people who wrote. But by and large, it is a generation and two and three of white men who represent the only words that we collectively thought were important enough to preserve. Reality, as it then existed, chose their words to keep. And then their words, selected for the keeping, went on to frame a new reality. Remember that. It works both ways. And here is another truth. There was colonialism aplenty in this Kansas venture. It was a conquest of land, pure and simple, backed by a narrative of right for faith and freedom, and a supply chain of might. Think lawyers, guns, and money, and not necessarily in that order. This endeavor, I am sad to report, was also backed by racism. The South did not hold a monopoly on that, and we are still dealing with the fallout. A permanent ward of the state view of people of color underpinned the imaginings of our Massachusetts forebears. So did fear of brown skin. There were calls from our Unitarian ancestors for a separate peace and further, and I mean further, colonial initiatives. Let's send the people of color to, say, Grenada. Samuel Pomeroy, a Unitarian, penned just such an initiative, and President Lincoln signed off on it. Perhaps unsurprisingly, the government of Grenada said no thank you. These things are true. They're hard to countenance, and it is an even bigger ask of our hearts, of mine at least, to hold these truths while also acknowledging that these people, our historic forebears, accomplished something big, something worth doing. They and their families and their money and their faith, Kansas became a free state, one fiercely devoted until this present set of few years, fiercely devoted to free education and free press. Centuries, this land, literally the prairie underneath our feet right now, the forests and fields that surround us, this is what they fought for. This free soil in the name of a larger love. It's hard to remember, perhaps, in this era with the label of flyover country, this time of what's the matter with Kansas, the next New Englander who asks me with an air of superiority whether I've read that, so help me. But here's the thing. In the years plural before the Civil War, Kansas was the name on every breath. Not just Charles Robinson or Ephraim Newt or Samuel Pomeroy, those Unitarians and leaders here in the territory. I'm talking about Emerson, about Tyler, about Lincoln. Those people are writing and theorizing and waiting for the next dispatch from Lawrence. And meanwhile, people are being massacred here, being beaten in Boston in this state's name, in our collective name, that we might all grow to be more free. Their actions, declaring it necessary and living it out, even when it sometimes meant death and deprivation. These were tinned clam people, and some nights they ended up eating dust. That was brave as hell. And it was ethically complicated, and it remains so to this day. The Kansas emigration movement was a moral action in the context of a nation brought to the brink of epic bloodshed over the question of human enslavement in the name of economic gain. It was an immoral set of actions in a larger context. Both the legacy and rights of the First Nations people, the Delaware, the Wyandot, the Kansas, that were swept under the carpet. From the view also of the things we now know about genocide and structural racism, things we can no longer look away from. In some real ways, these folks, our forebears, they brought what they had practiced. They threw their stone. In some ways, they got it wrong. We enjoy the fruits of freedom, and we should celebrate that. But we enjoy them unequally, and our labor, our obligation, continues to help clean up that mess. And you know this. We Unitarians continue to do powerful, justice-seeking work in this movement, and we still get it wrong sometimes. May this knowledge make us humble, and may our determination to remake the world, to assist in that arc bending toward justice. Did you know Theodore Parker, too, was a supporter of fledgling Kansas, and that it was in that era and for this cause that he spoke those famous words, "The arc of the universe is long, and it bends toward justice." Let us wake. Let us wake unto the dream that they dreamed. Let us learn again to be skippers of stones ourselves, defiers of gravity who know where we came from. Let us choose to carefully aim for magic in where we might go next. Where do you personally have spin and speed as you move through this world? Where do we as a faith movement, as the current face of Unitarian Universalism, or where do you as a congregation have the skills to do something necessary and incandescent in this world? Sometimes, if we practice, we can do something that just for a little while defies gravity. And sometimes it's enough. I want you to note that in that song, and thank you so much, Jonathan and Amara, as in the Kansas Territory 2 centuries ago, defying gravity was dangerous. In the musical Wicked, if Elphaba chooses to fly, she is going to be discovered. She will be seen for the magical, seditious talent that she is. And yet, not for herself alone, but for what a people might become together, Elphaba rises. Sometimes it's worth it. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Martin Luther King gets credit for Parker's quote, but this one is one of his. And so I want to tell you a story about the Reverend Teresa Inez Soto, a friend of mine, a poet, a lawyer, and a minister. She has had cerebral palsy since she was born, ordained into our movement, and powerful. And I don't mean she is inspirational. I mean she kicks my butt. She applied for an internship in this movement. She was initially approved, but then she was turned down upon further thought that involved, without consulting her, an assay of her body and what it could do, and a look at the physical structure of a pulpit. Denied an internship that she had previously been offered. We need to realize that people's bodies, just as they were 2 centuries ago, they remain a site of control. Our analysis of people's worth, of their personhood, it affects voice and participation. It limits power. We need to realize that it was never about bodies or buildings, not with disability and not with slavery before that. It is what it always has been. Controlling power by controlling participation. So how does this play out across our movement? How did it manifest this spring, for example, as we struggled together to deal with white supremacy? Not just privilege, but white supremacy. First, in the exoneration of hiring practices that were intended to keep us comfortable, to keep our movement unchanging, using the words, not just qualified, but we need the right fit. What does the right fit mean? Several weeks later, as our movement continued to roil with unrest, with fear, and with the need for reimagining, our denominational magazine, the UU World, wrote about what's going on. The pain, the resignations, the controversy. And they ran their article with scare quotes. Critics decry white supremacy in our movement. Words make reality. And reality, again, forms words. This moment is about recognizing when the words, when the rules, when the agonizing slowness of the format in which we play the game itself have become the water which drags the stone below the surface. That our rules are not the arc of our power. They're not the aim of our throw. They don't hold within them the hopes of our trajectory. Sometimes the way that we have always done things is tantamount to holding love back rather than empowering it to move forward. The UU World did finally change that headline after repeated requests and argument from multiple parties. I want to be clear, though, that this is not about those other people, a staff writer, an editor, a denominational hierarchy and all that it has stood for over centuries. I am speaking to you of this because I have all of this living in my own heart. Exclusion and control are the games that I learned to play. Perhaps you did too. I know all of the rules. The truth is that faith, hope, and love come harder. I need this place for that. And so, I ask myself in my ministry, as Brian Stevenson asked us in this year's Where lecture at General Assembly, where is a preference for finality overcoming the hope of my faith? Where is attachment to a particular process thwarting my progress toward love? Which brings me back to that pro-infirmis video. If I say the words throwing stones, we probably think immediately of bringing people down. But this is a service about bettering our aim so that we can lift one another. Lift each other and lift what is truly human and remarkable just a bit higher. It's about breaking free of what holds us back, not because we subscribe to magical thinking, but because we know that magic can happen when we get creative together, because it has before. And so I tell you, we have an opportunity right now. Our work is never behind us. You, as congregations, are about to be invited to brainstorm about the next generation of our shared denominational social action campaign. Standing on the side of love, emphasis on standing, has been around for a decade. And now we are being asked to move. I will remind you that the 3/5 clause, that people of color could be counted as 3/5 of a person, that was the math we were doing in the early days of the Kansas Territory. And that then some people were displaced in the era of the Kansas immigrants, the tribes I mentioned to you. This is Teresa's own wording and her genius. We displaced some persons so that other persons could be seen as people. There is a similar kind of math happening here. Again, Teresa's words. If I'm invited in the door, she uses a scooter for mobility, but I can't pee, how much of a person do I count as? If my body is left out of worship imagery, the place where we gather to do the work of the holy, what are we saying? And what reality are our words creating for my body? There has always been a math of personhood. This is the logic of finality, and it makes a commodity of love and a scarcity of accessibility. As the late poet and activist Laura Hershey wrote in Translating the Crip, which I am excerpting here. I was going to read one line, but I'm reading a few more. It was too good to leave out. And I commend this to you in its fiery entirety. Translating the Crip. Can I translate myself to you? Do I need to? Do I want to? When I say disability, I mean all the brilliant ways that we get through the planned fractures of this world. When I say living in America today, I mean thriving and unwelcome, the irony of this only possible time and place. When I say cure, I mean erase. I mean eradicate the miracle of error. When I say safe, I mean no pill, no certified agency, no danger to myself, court order, no supervisory setting, no nurse can protect or defend or save me if you deny me power. When I say public transportation, I mean we all pay, we all ride, we all wait as long as necessary. When I say non-disabled privilege, I mean members-only thought processes and the violence of stares. By dancing, I mean, of course, dancing. We dance without coordination or hearing because music wells through walls. You're invited, but don't do us any favors. When I say anything, I know the risk. You will accuse me of courage. I know your language all too well, steeped in its syntax of overcoming adversity and limited resources. When I say courage, I mean you, sitting next to me, talking, both of us refusing to compare or hate ourselves. When I say ally, I mean I'll get back to you, and you better be there. I tell you again, you are likely to be asked for your input on changing, standing on the side of love. Not scrapping, changing. And I hope you will choose to be there. We have work to do now and again, and I hope, oh Kansans, that you will continue leading the way, knowing that sometimes we will get it wrong, not simply because sometimes the winds won't be favorable, but because our aim won't be true. And knowing also that each moment of history is an ask to declare ourselves. As Unitarians, we have, always. Not all at once. Back in the era of Bleeding Kansas, Unitarianism was not sure if it was going to be a thing, much less an abolitionist movement. But gradually, like ripples on a pond, a shared identity became clear. So many skipped stones launched in the name of a greater freedom, where eventually we learned to act together and to say the words, because I am a Unitarian, for faith and for freedom. Onward. Amen.